You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 21st of June 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Hello from the Dorey House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, coming up in the programme.
My Lord and members of the House of Commons. My government's priority is to secure the best possible deal as the country leaves the European Union.
The Queen's speech to open Parliament in the UK, shorter on content and shorter on ceremony than usual. But that's not the only reason why attention focused on her hat. Continuing with the theme of reading royal runes, we'll scrutinise the rearrangement of the order of succession in the House of Saud. After a week of extremely close encounters between NATO and Russian aircraft, we'll ask why this keeps happening and what happens if they get too close. And our business editor is in Zurich for this week's edition of Tall Story.
I've been to Switzerland's largest city several times and have always had a pleasant enough time. It's clean, safe, salubrious. But it has always felt a touch joyless as well. Too clean to have much grit, too safe to have much of an edge.
All that, plus our weekly entertainment roundup, the Asian newspapers and taxi for Uber's CEO. All that and more coming up in the next 60 minutes on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. First, a quick look at the day's other top stories. Mosul's Grand Mosque of Al-Nuri and its famous leaning minaret have been destroyed, apparently blown up by Islamic State as Iraqi and other allied forces advance further into Mosul's old city. The 12th century mosque was where Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi proclaimed the foundation of a new caliphate in July 2014. Romania's Prime Minister Sorin Grindeanu has been rolled by his own party after barely 6 months in office. His Social Democrat Party teamed up with their opposition to overwhelmingly pass a no-confidence motion. They objected to his failure to carry out economic reforms, though Mr. Grindeanu might rightly retort that Romania presently possesses the fastest-growing economy in the EU. A new nominee for Prime Minister will now have to be approved by President Klaus Johannes. King Maha Vajikara Longkorn of Thailand has escaped injury after an air pistol was fired at him while he was bicycling near Munich. The 64-year-old monarch, who owns two villas on Lake Starnberg, was shot at by a pair of teenage boys who may not have been aware of the identity of their target. Though at home, King Vajiralongkorn is protected by Lese Majeste laws which enforce prison sentences for so much as insulting him, he has not pressed charges, although under German law this is a matter for local prosecutors. And a report by the US Inspector General into the conduct of the war in Afghanistan has reached several scathing conclusions, not the least of which is that $28 million US dollars of American taxpayers' money was wasted on equipping Afghanistan's army with jungle camouflage fatigues, which, as John Sopko noted in a masterpiece of bureaucratic understatement, was not based on an evaluation of its appropriateness for the Afghan environment. Indeed not. Afghanistan is roughly 2% forest. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Here in the UK, the Queen's speech is one of the great occasions of state, the formal launch of the parliamentary year, with all the obscure pomp and eccentric circumstance this entails, at which the sovereign announces the anticipated legislative agenda of the government. This ritual was enacted today, but differed from the standard, with the usual pageantry scaled back roughly in proportion to the government's present command of the House of Commons. And rather than a crown, the Queen wore a hat, which many noticed was blue with an arrangement of yellow baubles, akin to the flag of a certain controversial political and economic union of 28 European states. With more on this and other potential subtexts and subplots, I'm joined by the historian Christopher Lee, author of This Sceptred Isle, among much else. Christopher, first of all, the hat. Was there any chance at all that Her Majesty was having a bit of a laugh?
I think that she's got a marvellous sense of humour. I've watched it over, I suppose, about sort of 25 years. And the other day she went off to make a formal visit to a hospital. And there was a children's ward. And she had this blue outfit on, in fact, very much like today's. And she put on a sort of a ginger colour hat. It was totally unfashionable. It was totally wrong for the outfit. It was totally right for the kids who stared at it. And as the Queen said, "And how are you today?" there were open mouths at this wonderful ginger hat that sat there like some sort of purring tomcat. And she said afterwards, she said, "I think that did rather well, don't you?"
But
and I think that, so don't misunderstand, but what was interesting there, wasn't it, was all the, some of the paraphernalia. They still had to go to the Tower of London. The water boatman still had to fetch the great crown. It still had to be in presence. It's more than just a hat. It's with diamonds. It is a symbol. And there was that sense of symbol that it was carried forward in, as if it was some sort of liturgy that it had to be there.
The crown was technically in the vicinity, though a lot of the usual pageantry was not. It's the first Queen's speech that's been scaled back on this order since 1974, I think. How significant is that?
Oh, well, it was just one of those occasions. You look at what's happening in the House of Commons. The House of Commons can't get to the Lords. It can't actually put together the sort of government business that it would want to put forward. And anyway, it would probably lose it, and that would mean a general election. And it's not unusual, or it's not rare, but it is quite unusual to some extent. For the next Parliament, next opening of Parliament, to be 2 years' time, it's going to be a long slog over Brexit. And therefore, the Queen couldn't do the normal thing. You know, she sits there with the Duke of Edinburgh on her left-hand side in his uniform of Lord High Admiral with more medals than you could have ever had campaigns for. And she says, "My government will." And then she reads something, and then she says again, "My government will." Well, in fact, there's not much will for her government at the moment. And I think that this is, we're being realistic here. It was almost one sort of subject.
Well, this is brings us to the more serious aspect of this conversation. The jury, I suspect, is going to remain out on whether the hat was her idea of a sly joke. But at a period of uncertainty like this, and assuming that there is further great uncertainty approaching over the next 2 years as whether this government or another government tries to muddle its way through Brexit, what role, or what do we know at least for sure about the role that the monarch plays behind the scenes? Does she just sit right out of it and wait for people to come to her when they've figured it all out, or does she play a more active role than that?
In theory, she sits and waits because she is a constitutional monarch. But the thing that people sometimes miss, and that is that the monarch, in particular this one, because she's been there for so long that most people would not remember her father, King George VI, the monarch's main role is to reflect the identity of the people. And when you reflect the identity of the people, you reflect not only their habits and the way they behave generally in the world, you reflect their issues and their concerns. And to some extent, the monarch has not, that monarch finds it very difficult sometimes to show that without trying to interfere. The heir to the throne, Prince Charles, doesn't have that problem. And he makes quite often sort of says, no, this is wrong or whatever. We all know about that. But I think that Queen Elizabeth actually does reflect that sort of identity. And therefore, in some ways, what we're seeing today, you know, the Queen in a costume, as my mother might have called it, the Prince of Wales alongside her in ordinary sort of civil clothes. I think we're getting towards the identity of the nation, its relationship with the monarch, that might succeed the glorious in excelsior type of monarchy that we've been used to for 5,000 years.
Well, because it's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because though the Windsors tend to be a long-lived bunch, at the risk of prompting morbid speculation, she can't go on forever. How much of our current understanding of the monarch's relationship to the nation and the monarch's relationship to the government has now become not so much a question of the monarch's relationship as Queen Elizabeth II's relationship? Because you're quite right, most British people alive now have no recollection of any other sovereign.
I think you're absolutely right on this, you know, because you think about it, apart from one remark she made about Horribilis, a bad year, I can't think of many things that she has said in all her reign that anybody's noticed. You know, you get the I will stuff, but nobody listens to that. And anyway, the government writes it. There's the Christmas message, but very few people could quote any, because that's the nearest you get to finding out the Queen's own feelings about anything. The Queen has played it brilliantly as far as the monarchy was conceived, in the late 40s, 1950s, when she grew into it. But what we're actually now having to ask ourselves, so where does this monarch go? And do we have to distinguish between two things? One is the monarchy, i.e. the idea of having a king or a queen, an heir to the king and the queen, etc. Or do we say, well, that's what we understand about the monarchy. In fact, what we're really talking about is the monarch, this particular monarch. I mean, Prince Charles is likely to be quite a different man, or quite a different monarch. He is likely to be far more in the sense of theatrical monarchy. I mean, we know all about him. We know so much about Prince Charles, and because he told us. Whereas we know absolutely nothing about Elizabeth II. After more than 60 years on the throne. And that is, I think, it's going to change. It'll change itself. It won't need any legislation. It won't need any move in the country about reflecting what they think about the monarchy. 9%, something like 9% would call themselves Republicans today. None of that actually matters. I think it'll be a great gradual transition. We will see it, or we won't see it, in one important aspect. The Queen, I suspect, will gradually sign fewer of these important proclamations and documents of law that she has to sign at the moment. And that will be gradually moved over to Prince Charles. We won't know so much about it, but those that do, and it usually leaks out, will recognise that we're in transition from one monarch to another.
Christopher Lee, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily live from Studio One at Midori House. Saudi Arabia has a new next in line following the decision by King Salman to elbow his nephew, Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, from the heir apparent slot in favour of his son, Prince Mohammed bin Salman. It may just be a straightforward favouring of one's own direct bloodline, but it may be more than that. The previous heir at 54 would have been on track to claim the crown in late middle age at the earliest. The new one is only 31. Prince Mohammed bin Nayef could conceivably end up ruling Saudi Arabia for decades. I'm joined with more by Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Shashank, has this come out of a clear blue sky? Is this surprising?
Good evening. No, I'm not sure it is. I think that we had seen the inexorable rise of Mohammed bin Salman over the past 18 months, both in his championing of the Yemen campaign, in his incredible ambitious proposals to do things like reform the Saudi economy by selling off bits of the national oil company, Aramco, and the way in which he was amassing power at the expense of Mohammed bin Nayef, the previous crown prince, week after week, sacking one of his aides very recently, for example. I think most observers of Saudi Arabia thought it was only a matter of time before this occurred. And if it hadn't occurred, I think they would have assumed succession would have skipped over Mohammed bin Nayef, whatever the formal hierarchy.
Why has Mohammed bin Salman been able to rise so fast? Obviously, being the king's son never hurts, but there are, as anybody who's spent any time contemplating Saudi Arabia will realise, literally dozens, hundreds of princes. What's special about him?
Well, we don't really have a very good answer to that. You start off being the king's son, and he proved himself perhaps through his vision he set out, his, you know, Vision 2030, his plan for very ambitious economic and social reform of Saudi Arabia, his relative youth in a country which has been ruled by, you know, octogenarians and others. It, you know, makes Brezhnev's Soviet Union look like, you know, sort of momentum or something like that. It's an incredibly aged leadership. And here is MBS, this guy who is breathing fresh air into this moribund leadership that's run out of ideas. I think also it's a very tense time in the kingdom in terms of its regional policies, tension with Iran. MBS has not only articulated a very hard line against Iran, but also has cultivated extremely good ties with the most influential leaders of the United Arab Emirates. And at a time when Saudi Arabia is not only confronting Iran, but also confronting its fellow GCC member, Qatar, MBS is a voice who fits with these times.
You're quite right to refer to the Saudi Arabian leadership as aged, of course. It traditionally has been. The current king is 81. Have we learned here something about the current king's fears for his own health? Does he want to get the succession lined up while he still can?
Well, you know, there are a few facts in this area, just speculation, but for a long time, people have suggested King Salman has some sort of dementia or at least some kind of degenerative condition that may be affecting him in office and that may shorten his lifespan. And in a way, if you leave it till you're too late, palace intrigue is going to intensify. And you never know, Mohammed bin Salman was gaining enemies, not only from people like Mohammed bin Nayef, who he'd been muscling out, as I said, but also from many others who were very concerned by his brash style, the fact that his campaign in Yemen effectively failed at considerable cost, the fact that he was pushing a very aggressive foreign policy, and indeed shaking things up in the economy in ways that probably affected a great many vested interests. And in that sense, had he been allowed to continue, who knows whether he'd have been overthrown, who knows whether he'd have been muscled out, whether something would have happened that would have precluded his elevation in this way. So you may well be right. This was a way of securing that succession in advance. What I would say is that just because you're the heir to the throne on paper does not mean that that is how it necessarily works out in practice. It can, of course, just put an even bigger crosshairs on your back.
You mentioned the campaign in Yemen, which, as you say, has been widely perceived as having been Prince Mohammed's pet project. As you also correctly point out, it has gone other than swimmingly, I think, from a Saudi Arabian point of view. Shouldn't that have hobbled his ascent?
Well, I think it's possible it should have done, but the Saudis are still claiming that it's a success, rather implausibly. They're claiming, I think justifiably, that it did push the Houthis, the militia group inside Yemen that had effectively taken over the country and had gone to Saudi's borders. It had pushed them back and made them less able to threaten Saudi Arabia. And of course, also that ultimately, however badly the campaign was going, if it hadn't taken place, that Iran would be controlling what the Saudis see as another Arab capital on top of Beirut, Baghdad, and Damascus, and it would effectively extend the Shia crescent. So it's, in other words, it's possible that the Iran threat perception in Riyadh is so high, particularly after, you know, the attack in Tehran and the spike in tensions, that effectively it trumped any suggestion that the war had been Saudi Arabia's Vietnam.
Shashank Joshi at RUSI, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Now, encounters, even close ones, between Russian and Western military aircraft around the fringes of their respective national airspaces are not unusual in themselves. This week, however, has seen a couple of airborne face-offs which appear to have been unusually high-risk manoeuvres. Today, a NATO aircraft approached a Russian government jet carrying Defence Minister Sergei Shoigu as it flew to the Russian exclave of Kaliningrad, and earlier this week, a Russian jet was reported to have flown within 1.5 metres of a US spy plane over the Baltic Sea. I'm joined now by Major General Tim Cross, a regular Monocle 24 contributor. Tim, first of all, I wanted to ask about that story about the 1.5 metres or about 5 feet pass. That's a tricky enough margin going around Hyde Park Corner in a taxi. Is that even possible in a Sukhoi Su-22?
Well, it isn't easy. So it's sort of Red Arrow's flying display distances, isn't it? I think it is very close, and I doubt that the intention was to be that close, to be honest. It's very difficult to know what lies behind this stuff. It's not unusual in terms of flying close to and alongside, you know, aircraft from within these different countries. I mean, in the old days, the Soviet Union, Warsaw Pact, and NATO and so forth, and it still happens a fair bit over British airspace, for example. And indeed, ships can try the same thing too. But, you know, that is extremely close, and I suspect there was a big sigh of relief that nothing happened as a result of it. And that is the problem, of course. The problem is, if somebody makes a small mistake, it can have strategic consequences.
How common are these close encounters, though? Not necessarily within 5 feet, but they have become a bit of a regular on social media in particular, sort of various pictures of rival pilots waving to each other from their cockpits and so on.
Yeah, I mean, they're not commonplace. I mean, I don't think we should overplay this. It doesn't happen every 5 minutes, but and it's not unusual, as I said earlier. But I think there is inevitably this tension building as a result of the Baltics, as a result of Syria, and as a result of, you know, the coalition shot down the Syrian aircraft earlier on this week. The Russians have now said that anything west of the Euphrates is a legitimate target for them. So, you know, there's definitely tension. And in those circumstances, people will be prepared to push a bit harder to try and get reactions, try and get people to overreact and so on. So it's definitely worse than it was, but I don't think we should necessarily overplay it, if you see what I mean.
You talk there about reactions and overreactions. If you are the force commanders of one of, you know, a squadron, yeah, of aircraft or their civilian overlords, is there an actual strategic point to this?
Well, I think there is. I think it's too difficult to say specifically what that might look like. But the strategic point is that the Russians are obviously irritated and have been for some time in the way that NATO has pushed up hard against their border, you know, invited other countries to be part of it and so on. And Russia does not want to be seen to be on the back foot too much. So they will be pressing hard to show, you know, to show force, to show capability, to show people that they're not prepared to be pushed around. NATO, I think, is not wanting to push this too hard, and therefore I think will always be prepared to draw back from, you know, trying to make a too strong a statement. When it comes to this business of not flying west of the Euphrates, for example, I mean, the Australians have just announced it too. Well, they never were flying west of the Euphrates, and we, the UK, are concentrating on Raqqa. We're not flying manned flights west of the Euphrates. Now, you know, UAVs are different. I think UAVs are being flown in that region, but, you know, we I think will want to step back from it a little bit. I think the Russians will push hard. The Syrians obviously will want to push hard, but I don't think anybody wants a shooting war between Russia and the West, you know, and particularly for that to escalate.
But in terms of the encounters, especially between Russian and NATO aircraft, and you have incidences and have had incidences when, you know, Typhoons and Jaguars have been scrambled out of RAF bases in Britain to sort of meet Russian bombers, which are looming vaguely towards British airspace. Would we be correct in assuming that this is all terrific fun for the pilots?
Well, I'm not a pilot, but I know quite a few people who are. And I mean, fun is too strong a word. But, you know, the incursions into British airspace by bear bombers and others, and indeed submarines and so forth, has been going on for decades. The actual process of being, you know, sent up to interdict these things and to monitor them and so forth, is actually extremely good and valuable experience for people. So they don't decry it. They're quite happy to be involved with it. I don't think they see it as fun in the context that they know, as I've just been saying, that, you know, if something were to go wrong, there are strategic consequences. But the whole process, the standard operational procedures of getting aircraft in the sky, getting them to interdict these bear bombers and so forth, is very good for constantly keeping people at the front edge of their capabilities.
On the subject of consequences, though, if we look at this most recent incident, and we are so far taking Russia's word for this, so all due health warnings apply, but if it was actually the case that a NATO F-16 had buzzed the Russian government jet carrying the Russian defence minister, would the pilot of that aircraft be in a bit of trouble when he got back to base?
Well, I don't know enough about this particular incident, so one's got to be pretty careful here. I don't know, you know, where that happened in terms of the actual airspace, or whether the people concerned knew that the Russian defense minister was in the airplane. Frankly, I very much doubt it. So it would depend upon, you know, where that aircraft actually was, in whose airspace it was, whether the pilot had been told to go and interdict it or intercept it because it looked like it was going to infringe into NATO airspace. So I don't think the pilot is going to be held up to opprobrium here. It'll be the people who decided to send them up. But I doubt that they knew the Russian defense minister was in the airplane. I may be wrong, but I would be surprised if they did. And if they did know that, I would be very surprised if they deliberately pushed the envelope on this.
Major General Tim Cross, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily.
How do Europe's business leaders start their day?
Everyone's seeing the possibility of what reforms could do to unleash the power of the Indian economy is really exciting.
Who tracks the stories that really matter like no one else?
You're going to take so much money out of the Greek economy that they can't possibly generate growth. You have to manage a transition to a more private-oriented economy.
Where can you have a real conversation to kickstart your working day?
You don't mean the referendum on gay marriage, do you?
I don't. Surprising.
Very interesting. And the International New York Times has a piece. They assume that it will be passed. Mm-hmm.
The answer to all these questions is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Weekdays at 7 a.m. in London.
Da Midori House a Londra, state ascoltando Monocle 24.
24 tuntia vuorokaudessa. Tämä on Monocle 24.
24 hours per dia, esta è Monocle 24.
Keeping an eye and an ear on the world. This is Monocle 24.
Распространяем по всему миру из Лондона 24 часа в день. Это Monocle 24.
А Натани, Monocle 24 вот так и шмат.
Андарледи, ледледа бид, тригадол адив. Дема Monocle педуар архигай.
You're listening to the Monocle Daily now. The mixed blessing of a time-served brand heritage. PepsiCo find themselves on the receiving end of a petition to change the name of Aunt Jemima pancake syrup, launched by some who've taken offence at its deployment as avatar of an image of a smiling black woman. The change.org petition in question currently stands at about 260 supporters, so possibly not indicative of a huge groundswell. But is there a case against Aunt Jemima? A bit earlier I spoke about this with the author and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb and Monocle 24's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
I think historically, I've been reading a bit about the story, perhaps there is, but I think the brand should look, and they should just update, I think...
Well, their argument is that they have. It originated as a minstrel character, a straightforward minstrel caricature, but they do keep suggesting that since then they have updated it and tried to move with the times, etc. And I think, disconnected from its history, it now just looks like a picture of a smiling black woman, but nonetheless, there is the thing behind it.
Well, originally I would say, perhaps there was not a problem, but looking at the history of the company and when it was found, where there was still slavery, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I think perhaps they should change just because of the US history and what happened.
Where is the threshold for this, Michael? There are various other brands and images around the world that have done this. Robertson's here in the UK, Robertson's Jam, called off its Gollywog mascot as recently as 2001, yeah. Which is extraordinary. Crazy Horse Whiskey changed its name to Crazy Stallion after obvious objections were raised. I mean, the trouble is with things like this, it's hard to frame hard and fast rules.
It's very difficult. And did you ever go to the cinema here and see a drink called Kia Ora that had really, I mean, it was...
That was available in Australia, I seem to recall, as well.
And it was, you know, it was an orange drink, and there was this Jamaican guy, and it was racist, and they did finally pull it from the screens. The thing with Aunt Jemima as a brand, it's just the ongoing post-civil rights debate. I mean, this petition was started by some very well-to-do African-Americans who are in the business. And, you know, say, well, we're going to take this away. And they say, well, what? And you recall all prints have gone with the wind and excise all the scenes with Butterfly McQueen.
This similar argument has, of course, been had about the removal of Confederate statues in Louisiana, etc.
I've grown up with arguments about Step and Fetch It being just an awful stereotype. And 20 years later, young African-Americans who've got PhDs in cultural studies start defending Step and Fetch It and seeing in him a subversive form of performance. So it's a really dodgy thing, and that may explain why there's only 300 signatures. I am inclined to agree with Fernando, though. I mean, the Aunt Jemima I grew up with was a really heavy black woman. She's now slimmer. But it may well be time to just leave the name and perhaps have some kind of logo design as a kind of compromise for Pepsi Company to make about how to advertise this.
And, you know, I'm a believer that I don't think we should force them to do anything. I think the company, really, they should have a board meeting and say, listen, let's do the right thing. It's the same, you know, I can imagine in my home country, Brazil, where in the 80s and 90s, even on TV, you had these blonde TV presenters dressed up as indigenous ladies and singing like, ooh, you know, those traditional songs. And of course, this would be unacceptable today. But naturally, I think people just realize that this is not okay.
Exactly. And, you know, very interestingly, the Supreme Court ruled this week. There's been a huge controversy for a couple of decades now about the team name for the Washington American football
team. Redskins.
So Redskins. Now, Redskin is regarded by Native Americans as being on a par with the N-word. You know, Chiefs, they can deal with. You know, Braves, well, okay. But Redskin is a straight-up racist term. And the team was taken to court. It went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled that it was a First Amendment issue and corporations have the right to call themselves whatever they like. And so it remains in place. I mean, so Pepsi is under no pressure legally. It's simply a question of economically.
Michael Goldfarb and Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to me earlier. Now, moving seamlessly along on the subject of brand identity issues, the ride-hailing app Uber has revolutionized inner-city transport, but it may also, if unintentionally, be in the process of revolutionizing corporate governance, in that Uber is now effectively an experiment in how long and how well a company can run with nobody in charge of it. Following a series of resignations by senior staff in scandals occasioned by what seems an altogether toxic office culture, CEO and co-founder Travis Kalanick has now joined the exodus. Well, Alison Griswold is a reporter for the business media outlet Quartz. She's been covering the ins and outs of the Uber story. She joins us from Quartz's New York office. Alison, was Travis Kalanick always doomed? Was there any way he could have avoided this?
It's an interesting question. I think the writing was sort of on the wall for him probably for the last month or so, as the real shakeout of a lot of the sexual harassment scandals and other misconduct at Uber started to become clear.
So what do we know about how unsavory the corporate culture had become?
So it's interesting because a lot of the things that have come out this year are actually old in the sense that they're scandals that took place in 2014 or 2015. But have only been revealed this year. And the impetus for that was sort of when you had this former Uber engineer named Susan Fowler write a blog post about the harassment she experienced during her year at Uber. And it was sort of like that just opened the floodgates. And after that, all these other stories started to come out.
There has been, as you suggest, an extraordinary outpouring of stories of fairly monstrous behavior, which prompts many questions, but not the least of which is, how is any of this possible at a 21st century company, which exists mostly online, which is to say in an environment in which really, surely, everybody's going to get found out eventually?
Well, it's sort of something that we've seen happen with a lot of different startups. There are plenty of examples of startup culture gone awry. But Uber, you have to keep in mind, has become the world's most valuable private technology company in a relatively short time span. It's valued at nearly $70 billion. It operates around the world. It's in hundreds of cities. And to have that kind of unprecedented growth, Uber sort of left a lot of decisions to the teams running things at the local level. And so that really helps the culture come from the top, as the saying goes, because if those people are being appointed in the image of the CEO, who himself is not the best example of leadership, then that will just entrench and perpetuate those problems.
This is a question being advanced not in any way as an excuse, because there is no excuse for a lot of the behavior that has been discussed or alleged, et cetera, but is it an explanation, perhaps, that the kind of buccaneering, disruptive ethos that they brought to building the company has sort of spilled over into other areas of life as well?
I think certainly. I mean, one of the things that Travis Kalanick really did for Uber is you can say he made Uber great. I mean, he was the person that broke laws and went into cities and defied regulators and ignored taxi protests. He was willing to push those boundaries and break those rules where other companies weren't. And if you believe, as many people do, that the ride-hailing market is sort of a winner-take-all setup or a first-mover advantage, then you can't understate how important it was that the CEO was willing to break all the rules to get in first.
And did these scandals have any demonstrable effect on Uber's bottom line?
It's hard to say. So what we've seen is that this year they've continued to grow their ridership. Their average transaction value is up, according to some third-party data. At the same time, you've seen their competitors, like Lyft, mainly benefit from the anti-Uber sentiment, and their market share is also up in the U.S. So it's sort of a two-sided question in that way.
As you said, Uber was built very much in Travis Kalanick's image, as I guess startups are want to be. For all the bad stuff they get rid of in getting rid of him and getting rid of everybody else who's gone in the last few weeks and months, what will they miss about Travis Kalanick, and how do they compensate for that?
Well, in a lot of ways, Travis Kalanick is Uber. He is the person who had the idea, who created the culture, who set the way of doing business that has made them the company they are. And it's always a question with a startup. How do you transition from investing in the person, as investors often say they do, to investing in the company, especially when the company is such a mature, large, valuable global business?
So, as you point out, Uber is a huge company, and it has become emblematic of startup culture in Silicon Valley in particular because of its size and its growth. But in terms of its corporate culture, how emblematic is that? Is it is Uber an exception, or is it the rule in Silicon Valley?
Well, I think what we've seen is that in the past, when scandals like this have appeared, often to do with sexual harassment or sexual misconduct, they've very much been things that there's a brief flare-up of outrage around, but then it sort of goes away and people forget. And Uber is interesting in that it was almost like when that blog post by Susan Fowler came out, it was the match that lit everything on fire. It was sort of like there was so much accrued bad will against them because of how they treat their drivers and their surge pricing, and they're breaking rules and making fun of politicians. Like, there were all these things that was like the final straw. And I think that's part of why you've seen people react so strongly to what's going on at Uber in a way that you haven't seen as much with other startups.
Alison Griswold at Quartz, thanks for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
The Monocle Weekly, our original Sunday show, brings you the best interviews with the writers, artists, thinkers, and innovators that shape our times. Also featuring fearless presenters.
It's not illegal, but it does have an effect.
Uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. How traumatised am I going
to
be?
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
Who ask the probing questions.
What is the kinkiest animal?
That's pretty kinky.
Headless thrusting.
And a good old-fashioned star turn or two, just for good measure.
We had a small editorial conference today where everyone was going, what do you think of Kylie's concert? When did you go? When are you going? What's happening?
So, yeah, I heard you guys had a debrief.
Yeah, we've had
today.
A debrief.
That's the Monocle Weekly. Sundays at 12 noon London time on Monocle 24. You wouldn't want to finish your week without it.
We turn now to this week's edition of Tall Stories, a weekly feature by the team behind The Urbanist, which takes you on an urban journey each week, uncovering a building, bridge or location in a different city. For this week's edition, Monocle's business editor Matt Alagaya tells us why his latest trip to Zurich has been different from any other before it.
Okay, I have to come clean. Until last week, I didn't really get Zurich. The city has always appeared in Monocle's annual Quality of Life survey, our index of the top 25 most livable cities in the world. In fact, I can reveal that it's also made it into 2017's ranking, out later this week in the July-August issue. Still, even with that ringing endorsement in mind, I never really understood myself what all the fuss was about. I've been to Switzerland's largest city several times and have always had a pleasant enough time. It's clean, safe, salubrious, but it has always felt a touch joyless as well. Too clean to have much grit, too safe to have much of an edge. I've always found it to be a bit aloof too, particularly when compared to a warm and welcoming city like Lisbon, for instance. But last week I was forced to admit the error of my judgment. The crucial factor that I'd always missed? Simple. It was summer. Every other time I've been to Zurich, it's been the wrong side of September or the bleaker side of May. There's been a chill in the air, clouds in the sky, and no reason to linger outdoors. Last week, though, we were treated to a glorious June day. The sun was out and the mercury hit 28 degrees. Along with a few colleagues, I wandered down from our office on Nordstrasse to the Flussbad, the river swimming pool, Oberletten. What a difference a few months make. Here was the shimmering, crystal-clear water of the Limmat River. Here were healthily tanned bodies drying off in the sun, and yet more bobbing downstream on the gentle current, some with their belongings in a dry bag, using the stream as a cheap and cheerful form of urban transport. Here were students working on laptops and office workers on extended lunch breaks. Here were beers and bratwurst on the decking, and laughter and cigarette smoke carried off on the breeze. Of course, this is why you'd want to live here. This being Switzerland, the whole setup was wonderfully efficient and civilized. Swimmers can rent clean towels and get dressed in pristine changing rooms. There's a small lending library for those who have come down and forgotten their favorite paperback. And ashtrays, fashioned out of aluminium tins, can be borrowed from a shelf, provided they're eventually returned. Yet the Flussbad also reveals an aspect of a uniquely Swiss view on life. That is, a mild disdain for nanny state-style interventions. In other cities, you know who you are, such an experience would have been hindered by rules and regulations, by whistles and warning signs. Here, however, in typically Swiss libertarian style, the authorities trust you largely to look after yourself and your fellow citizens too.
Blue skies all the way. We laugh, we joke, we sing. What a beautiful day. Not a cloud in our sight. It's such an adventure, my baby, you and I.
Nobody in a high-vis jacket shouted at anyone to stop running. There were no signs pointing to a grim smoking area, and the barman didn't prevent you from taking your glass off the premises. Again, I had to admit I was impressed. Yes, perhaps Zurich is a bit too clean and safe, and no, perhaps there isn't quite enough grit and edge here. But really, what more can you ask for from your city than a swim in the bracing water of the Limmat, a bit of decking for soaking up the sun, and to be left alone to enjoy it in peace?
That was Matt Allagaier in Zurich. You are listening to The Daily. It's time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We are joined once again by Michael Bueller from the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS here in London. Michael, welcome back to the show. We're starting with the Nikkei Asian Review. This is, well, it starts out with, I don't want to call Cambodia a small story because Cambodia is a significant country, but it's looking at a particular thing about Cambodia and making a wider extrapolation about Southeast Asia's democratic deficit, as it puts it.
Yeah, so Hun Sen has apparently now said we have elections coming up in Cambodia, and so Hun Sen has basically said that if there should be a civil war in Cambodia after elections, he's just fine with it. And so the article really talks about why we see a democratic rollback across the region.
That is a weird thing to say if you are in charge of a country, and indeed have been for as long as anybody can remember. Why does Hun Sen think that there might be a civil war if he loses the election? This sounds like rather more a threat than a promise.
Well, I mean, the CPP has actually, you know, not been very good at winning these elections. They have actually won since 1993, and or basically have lost one election in 1993, but ever since have won. But it's not really an outright kind of authoritarian system like, let's say, for instance, Singapore, where the PAP wins regularly with very high majorities. And so Hun Sen is probably getting increasingly nervous with regard to the upcoming elections. And so that's probably just a signal to his opponents that they should just be, ready for repercussions should they actually try to really win these elections.
Is that especially provocative talk coming in the context of Cambodia's reasonably recent history? Of course, I mean, it's 75, 79, the Cambodian Civil War is a while ago now, but nonetheless, there will be people who survived that period who remember it, and it was no small change. Like a quite hefty fraction of Cambodia's population was wiped out.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, the Khmer Rouge trial has just broken down this week, right? And so a very insensitive comment, of course, to make in any kind of context, but especially given Cambodia's history, absolutely.
Well, we shall keep an eye on that, but it is, I think everybody gets a bit strange when they've been in power for a while, and that is a fairly unarguable illustration of that. I want to move on to the new Mandala. This is a story we have been following, and I think it's a story that caught a lot of the world's media out. This is the fighting over Marawi in the Philippines. And again, I don't think this can be overstressed. It is not a... This is not a small thing. This is a decent-sized city which has been overrun more or less out of the blue by Islamic State. I think comparisons with the takeover of Mosul a few years back are not unwarranted. This piece by Harinesh Damado, talking about Marawi after it's liberated, recaptured, whatever else you want to call it.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. So Marawi City has 200,000 inhabitants, and so a fairly large city is now under the control, and has been for a couple of weeks now, of the so-called Maute clan, which is a family, actually, that has sort of managed to attract Islamic fighters from around the world. And so this article here basically talks about what will happen to the city once the government actually has won Burundi's local insurgency. And basically, it points out that it's going to be very difficult to basically, do something about this conflict, because there's an overlap between tribal structures and these religious conflicts and to just outright criminal activities.
What does it tell us about the challenge that face the Filipino authorities beyond the immediate task of obviously getting Marawi back from the jihadists? What actually needs to happen next, I guess, in order to minimize the chances of this happening again?
Well, I mean, what's interesting is that these kind of religious insurgencies were actually quite unknown in the 1970s, 1980s, when a lot of these local leaders were actually given lucrative positions in Manila, in the central government, and that has since basically not happened anymore. And so suddenly a lot of these local leaders have started to couch their grievances they have with the national level government in religious terms. And so I guess probably an integration of these kind of local elites into the broader kind of Philippine political ecology is probably one way to go forward.
So does that suggest that a bit of cynical patronage is going to be in order to try and buy these people off?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the kind of ceasefire capitalism that we see in Burma as well certainly would probably be a way to go about
ceasefire capitalism is a lovely phrase, and I think it is often actually under-discussed and underrated how often civil wars are to some extent a protection racket, i.e. give us a lot of money or we'll keep doing this.
I mean, that's essentially how the Americans basically made headway in Afghanistan, right? The surge was essentially that.
Eventually so, yes. Moving along to the Asia Times, this is an extraordinary story, a political story out of Singapore. Singapore, of course, has prided itself on decades of discreet, orderly, frankly boring, all but one party government, in fact almost one family government. They seem like roughly the last people in the world who would be conducting a family feud in public, and yet
that's exactly what happened. Yeah, so it's become very interesting to read the Straits Times, which is usually not the most interesting paper, the Singaporean
national
paper. That's
a fabulous understatement. It is usually a cure for the most, well, deep-seated insomnia of the Straits Times, but this is extraordinary stuff.
Yeah, so basically the younger siblings of the current prime minister have now gone public and have accused him pretty much of everything. They basically said he's abused his power. He basically has given his wife certain kind of positions within the government she shouldn't have, and apparently the current prime minister is also trying to install his own son as the next prime minister. And so this is quite explosive material, because as the article mentions here, the New York Times and the International Herald Tribune were sued in the past for merely suggesting that there are dynastic politics at play in Singapore.
I mean, is there dynastic politics going on here? Is there any suggestion that this is an actual power grab by any of the prime minister's brothers, or is it just a family feud about other things entirely?
I mean, it probably started out as a family feud. The origin of this dispute seemed to be that basically Lee Kuan Yew wanted his house to be destroyed after he basically ceased to be prime minister. And so basically the two younger siblings said that the current prime minister, the son of Lee Kuan Yew, should basically respect that wish. And he has apparently not done so, and has sort of tried to turn the family home into some sort of a shrine for the lay prime minister. And so that's probably what triggered this feud. But then these allegations of corruption and basically an abuse of power are quite astonishing for Singapore.
I mean, at best, this is terrifically undignified. Does it damage the prime minister at all?
Well, I mean, he's now basically launched a counterattack. So late this week, he basically will receive questions and then provide answers from the Singaporean parliament. And so people have said that this is a way to reclaim the narrative, because, of course, the Singaporean parliament is dominated by the PAP, which is the party that he's from.
Well, turning finally and just briefly to a story by Aman Rahman in the Jakarta Post. I like this story. It's a story that's been getting being a... Well, I mean, people are chuckling about this invention because of the way this invention works, but this is actually an extraordinarily good idea.
Yeah, so in Indonesia, many people basically get into car accidents because they fall asleep while they're driving, and so this is now an invention by a young female Indonesian engineering student who basically invented a device that pinches your butt when you basically are at risk of falling asleep.
Yes, as I understand the mechanics of it, as far as I understand the mechanics of anything, it is a sensor on your wrist monitors your heart rate, and if it drops below a certain point, it pinches you.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Of course, I wonder what happens if you just fall asleep because you stay in traffic jams in Jakarta.
Michael Bueller from SOAS, thank you, as always, for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Finally tonight on The Daily, our weekly entertainment slot, wherein Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco this week talks about the North American singles chart, the launch of Vogue Poland, and yes, how a character from a Brazilian children's TV series has become a gay icon.
The summer hit Despacito by Puerto Rican singer Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee, featuring Justin Bieber, remain atop the North American singles chart for the sixth week in a row, which means that Bieber has the three top-selling songs of the week. And number two is his collaboration with DJ Khaled, Quavo, Chance the Rapper, and Lil Wayne. I'm the One. And at number three, his collaboration with French DJ David Guetta, To You. In the album's chart, Katy Perry claims her third number one album with Witness. Swish, swish, bish. Another one in the basket. Your game is and now, to the crazy world of Brazilian memes. The country prides itself to produce the most fun and effective memes. And this week, a character from the classic children TV series called Sítio do Pica-Pau Amarelo, or the Yellow Woodpecker Ranch in English, became a gay icon and the queen of memes. The character is Cuca, a sassy alligator witch with a blonde wig. Although Cuca is part of the Brazilian folklore, the memes are from the 2001 TV adaptation of the series. Here is a bit of Cuca for you.
Ai, vem com a coquinha, vem. Eu estou precisando tanto do seu veneninho. Oh, minha amiguinha querida.
Isso que está aprontando alguma coisa, hein?
And finally to Poland, where publishers Condé Nast announced the launch of Vogue Poland next year to tap into the country's almost $600 million luxury market. It is also part of a plan to expand the brand across Eastern Europe. Filip Nedentał will be the editor-in-chief, with Polish model Małgosia Bela the editor-at-large. The last major launch of Vogue in Eastern Europe was back in 2013 with Vogue Ukraine. For Monocle, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And that is it for tonight's edition of The Daily. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. The researchers were Jolene Goffin and Fiametta Chazana. Our studio manager was George McDonough. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. I'll be your host for that as well. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening.